Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever see the concrete stairs of every day? The lunatic, the hypocrite are all lost in the fray. Can't see their lives are just like yours. An unpersonal and undiscovered door leading to the gift of hope renewed, eternity for you. The masses of humanity have always had to suffer.
Hello.
Yes, Jay. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing all right. A lot of walking.
Good.
That's keeping me sane.
Walking?
Yeah, getting out in the nature. And I moved out of the city. I left London 2 months ago now because all my work had dried up, basically. I DJ and I tour, and that's how I make the majority of my money. So with shows gone,
like
I thought it's time to leave London and get out of the city, and that's what I've done. And yeah, it's been good. How about you? Are you LA-based?
Well, south. I'm in Orange County, but yeah, I'm in Southern California. I came back to the beach. I just moved down to Huntington Beach and said I'm just going to surf all the time because that's what I'd rather do.
Well, that's, you know, there's worse ways to spend your time, isn't there?
Yeah. Yes.
It's a pleasure to have you on the show, mate. I've been doing this for almost 4 years now, and one of the first episodes I did was with Dave Haas, and lovely guy, and we had a very deep, profound chat in the episode that we did, and he was at the early stages of his sobriety, and he was sort of telling me that you'd been a real friend and a mentor to him in that regard, and since then I've kind of been following you, not to sound weird, but I've been following you on Instagram and stuff, and I just really like the vibe that you put out into the world and the honesty with which you approach that subject from time to time on there. And yeah, man. So it's nice to sit down and talk with you. Hopefully we will get into some of that perhaps a little further down the line, but I don't want to jump straight in with the deep stuff.
I'm open to anything.
Lovely stuff. Well, that's my dream guest right there, Jay. And I also, I spoke to Joey Cape when you guys were last over in the UK doing the Gimme's run, and again, Joey was like, he was telling me a lot about the early LA punk scene and some of those shows and bands, and he was like, oh, you've really got to get Jay on this show because he just remembers all that stuff way better than me. So that's kind of where I'd like to begin, if that's cool, is your introduction to punk growing up, whether it was a record or a person or a show, how did that light bulb get switched on for you?
Well, I had a friend that I went to school with named Matt Olshever, who had an older brother named Robert, who was really a music aficionado. I mean, he was, you know, an 18-year-old older brother. Oh, that's a reminder that I'm doing an interview. he was probably 17 or 18, and we were maybe 13, 14. But he had just an amazing record collection, and so there were things like the Pistols and the MC5 and Blondie and Devo and just, you know, all the stuff that was coming out that was new and exciting. But you know, when you were a 13-year-old kid, you were just barely getting out of whatever your comedy rock show thing was. And so that was the first time I'd heard the Pistols was at this guy's house. And I didn't think much of it because it just was, it was brash to me as a kid. You're like, oh, what the hell?
Yeah.
But I got it. Sometime later that year, I'm pretty sure it was that same year, there was a television show, The Year in Review. And it featured, like, the last 15 minutes of this television show was dedicated to the Sex Pistols and, like, how outrageous they were. And like, look at these people and this whole punk rock thing. And I was 13, 14, and I just was watching this and I said, that's it, I'm done. This is for me. And it really didn't have anything to do with the music as much as it had to do with just these people were just telling the world to fuck off, and I really liked that.
Is that because you were angry and had an anti-authoritarian streak about you, or is it just that it was exciting because you were young and it was different and it was in your face and, you know, it was naughty? And
I think there's part of it was, you know, come from a broken home, mom and dad divorced, my dad moved. Like, I know California is odd to people that don't live here. But we grew up in the high desert, sort of out by Magic Mountain. And my dad moved to the beach, to Manhattan Beach. And so I would spend my weekends at the beach, and I would spend almost all my summers at the beach. And so I was very aware of this alternative lifestyle that was this surf skate culture. And so there was that part of it that sort of made punk rock accessible to me. In other words, like, my sister would get the Cream magazine and you know, Hot and Hit Parade and all these, you know, all the rock magazines, and I was getting skateboard magazines. And there was guys like Dwayne Peters that were sort of like beginning this lifestyle image, but even the guys like Dogtown with their just fuck this attitude was just, that just spoke to me. I don't know why. I think it was part of the skate culture of that was initially sort of frowned upon by everybody because, oh, you do that. It's like, yeah, I do that. But I think that when I was old enough to really understand the lyrics of the music that was pulling me in, it was really the first time I heard Bodies. Because now I'd heard the Pistols at my friend's house, but there's only one or two songs. When I bought the record and I now I've got the album and I'm listening to it, and Bodies comes on and he says, fuck this, and fuck, and this guy saying fuck on the record. And I'm like, wow, like, this is unheard of. This is just, I'd heard punk rock, I'd heard Fast. You know, I got the excitement about it, but now this guy was swearing. And when you're a kid and someone's swearing on a record with that snarl, you're like, okay, I'm in. And then you start listening more intently to what they're saying. And that's when you find, for me, you start finding bands like The Jam and The Clash and the lyric and Elvis Costello. And these lyrics are more important than just saying, fuck this. And you're like, okay, this is how I feel. I'm too young to be able to say this, but he's putting it into words for me. These artists, these lyricists.
Bodies is a wild one because it's obviously a song about, like, being, you know, pro-choice, and it's addressing that topic of abortion in such a graphic, violent way, because obviously that subject matter requires that. And it's, you know, I come from Birmingham as well, so I was hearing him say she was a girl from Birmingham. I was like, wow, this [S2] Right. [S1] Is my home city directly being talked about. And I mean, that song for me now still is really affecting and unsettling, and it forces you to question life, doesn't it? Which is what all great provocative art, I think, should do. And I think that early scene and those early bands really did do that in a new way, didn't they? You know, from both sides of the pond.
Yeah, I think so. I think that there was this irreverence to whatever the decorum was previously about, you know, don't rock the boat, or, you know, I try to think of it in terms of like my dad in the 50s, and his like rockabilly thing, and looking at his dad going, what the hell are you listening to? And realizing like how dangerous Elvis Presley was and Carl Perkins. And
absolutely.
And all of these things that were happening, you know, that just seemed so terrifying to quote unquote adults. And that was what punk rock was for me. I was probably, in the beginning, I was probably really too immature to really understand the lyrics, to really grasp onto it. I knew there was a, like, in the, when you talk about Across the Pond stuff, one of the things that I always laughed about was, especially in like real hardcore, like deep punk rock bands, they were using British terms that I would never understand. Like, never. I didn't know what a nappy was. I didn't know what the dole was. I'm like, I don't understand. A pineapple? So, you know, it's one of those things where you just, because you can't grasp the concept, you just grab the emotion.
Yeah.
And so I think when I was that age, 13, 14, that emotion was this Tasmanian devil of anger and anxiety and, you know, just all the things that you're going through as a young teenager. And honestly, by the time we started the band, 15, 16, now I did understand lyrics a lot better. And these are the conversations that we had when we only had three or four songs. We were talking about what kind of songs we wanted to write. And so we all had a pretty good, I think we all came from that same era of, I'm caught up by the excitement, but I'm enamored with the possibilities of being able to say things that I wouldn't be able to say in a pop band.
Yeah, big time. Were you looking as well for want of a better term, for a new family to integrate yourself with, because yours was falling apart? And did punk rock and that community offer you that?
No, I wouldn't say that I was looking for anything. You know, when I cut my hair, cause I was a surfer, I had long hair. And when I cut my hair, I just, you know, it was just a random day. And I just walked into a Supercuts and said, I want you to cut my hair off and make it the spiky thing. Like, you know, they were all looking at me like I was crazy. They didn't know how to do it, but they cut my hair. I wasn't with anybody. I didn't think I was going to meet anybody. I was just going to do this, and that was the end of that discussion. And that was in the summer of 79. And then by the time I got back to school in 1980, that's when I met Greg. So we were the only two, you know, punk guys at our high school. So I wasn't looking for a community. We just found each other because we're it.
Yeah, I guess it was easy to spot fellow punks back then as well, wasn't it? Because there was so few of you and you stood out.
Yeah, there was no mistaking someone who bought into this lifestyle.
It was genuinely dangerous as well, I imagine, like walking around looking like that at that point in time.
Yeah. You know, especially where we were, because it wasn't a tourist area, and it certainly wasn't a hot spot of artist activity. We were just in a conservative neighborhood in the West San Fernando Valley, where people just had cookie cutter homes and didn't put up with a lot of shit, and all the kids drove Camaros and listened to Rush.
Yeah, was there a distinct division, and you talk about this a bit in the book, between the city punks and the valley kids, and were you sort of ostracized for not being from the city?
Sort of, but I think, you know, I think everybody was from, no matter where you, honestly, I don't think anybody really came from Hollywood except for older people, you know, people that could afford to live in Hollywood on their own.
Yeah.
And they were mostly the artist types. They weren't really skaters, you know. They weren't this alternative lifestyle punks. They were mostly alternative artists. That was the Hollywood people, and they were definitely an older crew. But if you were coming from the South Bay or you were coming from the Valley, you weren't from Hollywood. So nobody was really from Hollywood, but there were so few people from the Valley that it was, you know, people just said, what? Where are you from? Like, Woodland Hills. You're like, yeah, whatever.
It was such a wild time for not just music, but you've already mentioned it, for skateboarding as well. And those two cultures really did go hand in hand early on, didn't they? And, you know, I think that the scenes fed into each other, and you were obviously there for the birth of both. Like, were you around skaters as well as musicians early on? People like Dwayne Peters and Jay Adams and cats like that. Were you around them?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't friends with them because they lived pretty far away from me. But one of the places that I was all the time near my house was a place called Reseda Skater Cross. And this was one of those built skate parks. It's like a concrete run. And so it was one of the first ones that I knew of. There was one out in, down in Ontario, but this Reseda Skater Cross was where everybody came eventually. And I was always there because it was just right around the corner from my house. So I wasn't friends with any of those people, but I was definitely around them, and I could, and I knew when the Dogtown guys showed up, and I knew when like the kind of older punker guys showed up, and I was like, yeah, those are the guys. Those are the cool guys. Those are the guys I want to be.
Yeah.
But they, you know, it's funny because they were great at skateboarding, and I wasn't a very good skateboarder. I tried, but I was just like, this is, you know, I'm just not that guy. And in all honesty, when those guys showed up, like when the Dogtown guys showed up, I didn't want to be them as a skateboarder. I wanted to be them as a person.
Because they embodied rebellion and punk rock.
Yeah, yeah. Like when Tony Alva and Jay Adams and the Muirs were there, and I'm just like, yeah, these guys are badass.
I mean, yeah, there's that story in the book. I can't remember the exact details, but it kind of stood out, and it really brought home as exciting and, creative as that time was. There was also a dark underside, wasn't there? And there was a lot of violence and a lot of like unsavory incidences. And there's the story in the book where Jay gets in a fight with a guy in that parking lot and he accidentally kills someone, right? And didn't
yeah, you... but it wasn't him. Just to clarify that, like he did get in the fight with the guy, but and you know this was one of the things that I always like when I told the cops because they were saying it was him, and I said the funny thing was he was out cold, so it wasn't him,
right?
Because he may have started the fight, but that guy knocked him out, like knocked him right out. I'm like, no, he was out cold on the ground. He didn't finish anything. So,
and didn't you get arrested for that because you got identified as being there?
I did. Yeah.
I guess that was a moment when, you know, your parents must have realized, like, shit, he's running with a bad crowd.
yeah, but I don't think that there was any real way around that. It was just, it's not something that you can say it was inevitable, but I was just living that life, and you know. When that happened at Okie Dogs, I didn't like it, but I can guarantee you it wasn't the first time I'd ever seen it happen.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, you talk about that violence at the shows, and just, I mean, honestly, it was just in LA in general. I hate to say that because it sounds like, you know, I'm painting this picture of this dangerous city. But when you're a kid and you've already seen, you know, and I don't mean just in the punk rock world, but you've just seen people die in front of you, whether they've been shot or stabbed or hit by a car or whatever. You kind of get jaded to all that. You're like, oh, there's another dead guy.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I gather from a lot of those punk shows that it was common, wasn't it, for stabbings and fights and all of that. That was just like it was there. It was part of the DNA.
It definitely escalated, and there was always some shows where you knew it was going to be bad, maybe because of the bands that were playing. But I think there was an influx of people because back then punk shows were $3, whatever. And, you know, there just seemed to be this influx of people that would pay their $3 to come in and just bash heads. It was like their ticket to ride, was their entry cost, and they just came in and just fought people. And there was a lot of that. And then there was a handful of guys that fought back and just kind of said that we're trying to take our pit back from people that just want to fight by fighting them.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if that really worked, but that's what happens when you're 17 years old and you think you have answers.
Yeah. What about on the flip side to that, some happy memories from the legendary Starwood venue? That seems to be like a focal point of energy for this time and place and for so many bands and moments. Like that seemed to be the gathering spot, right? Is that safe to say?
Yeah, early on, you know, I think at least once a week there was always something happening there, and it had this sort of weird parking enclave where you didn't have to pay to get into this parking lot, but that's where everybody was hanging out. So you'd get in there and you'd just be hanging out with all their friends in the parking lot, and then someone would get enough money to get in, and everybody would transfer the stamp onto their hand.
Yeah,
you know, lick your hand, and then everybody would go in. And
classic.
Yeah, it was, you know, the Starwood was, it was funny because it was multiple rooms. There was one big live room, but there was a DJ room and a food room and a pool hall and blah, blah, blah. 10 places where you could kind of just piss off and go find anything to do. So, yeah, early on it was exciting. The funny thing was, there was a lot of guys that were coming there in to see punk shows. And I had already been to the Starwood to see Quiet Riot years before that, because they came and played at my high school. And I was like, Randy Rhoads is the greatest guitar player ever. So I just kind of followed him. And they're like, they're playing the Starwood. And I said, yeah, Mom, drive me to the Starwood. I'm going to go see this guy play guitar again. So I already knew what the Starwood was, which I shouldn't have, because, you know, it's like, well, how do you know this place? Like, I've been here a couple times.
So many great bands at that time as well. Did you play your first show as Bad Religion with Social Distortion? Is that right?
We did, yeah. Our actual first booked show was at a club that didn't open. Like, we had a booked show, we were going to go play, and then they never showed up to open the club. We were all stood around outside and said, I guess we're not playing. So the next show was with Social Distortion in Orange County, just in a warehouse full of people and a PA, and it was just us and Social Distortion, and you know, it was really terrifying, but I think that we all had a good enough time to want to do it again.
Yeah, you say in the book, Steve Soto, who was, I guess, a good friend of yours, he gave you some advice early on, which was to always drink at least a six-pack before you play, and that will get rid of the pre-show nerves.
The heebie-jeebies. Well, yeah, I mean, I was totally stone-cold sober, thrown up all over the place before we played because I was so nervous.
Wow.
But, you know, that's just, I don't know. I can remember that feeling of, it's like this anxious enjoyment. Like, you're going to get on this roller coaster that you know is terrifying, but you'll be okay.
Yeah.
And we'd never played in front of people before. So that was sort of what was terrifying about it, I guess. I never really thought about what was terrifying, but it was. But, you know, I guess the good part about being in a band is that, you know, the other guys are like, come on, let's go do this. You're like, yeah, let's do this. And then you go out and play your 8 songs and everybody's fine.
Was it a supportive, like, encouraging community and scene? Did all of you as bands, you know, lift each other up and spur each other on? Or was there a kind of healthy competitive element going on as well? Like, what was it like with bands like Social Distortion and Adolescence and Bad Religion?
It was a little bit of both. I think that, you know, we were what I call the third wave of this Southern California punk rock. And so the bands like Social Distortion and TSOL and us and the Adolescents, so we're part of this wave. And so we were always supportive of each other, but also competitive, like wanting to do as good as they were doing or whatever they were doing. The next level up guys, the Circle Jerks, Black Flag, they were our mentors. So we just kind of looked at them to, like, you know, lead the way, and we were just the kids and they were sort of the grown-ups. And then the first wave was like the Screamers and the Weirdos, and those were like the old guard, where you just, like, we don't even talk to those guys because we don't know anybody. But that third wave, we were all friends and competitive and super helpful to each other, you know, loaning gear. If we get a show, we would put them on the show. They would always put us on the shows. So, you know, it was, I can, one show, the Adolescents were playing a show, and I guess coincidentally, all of Bad Religion showed up. Me, Greg, Brett, and Jay Ziskrout all showed up. No, it was actually Pete Finestone showed up at a show that the Adolescents were playing, and they just said, you guys go play like four songs before we play. We weren't on the bill or anything. They just said, you guys go play our gear. And we're like, yeah, okay. So that kind of thing was always happening.
Amazing. And was Soto a good pal of yours over the years? Did you remain close?
Yeah. I mean, we all kind of, there was definitely a lot of years there where we didn't see each other because most of the bands broke up, kind of us included, and just sort of got on with their lives. And then by the time we came back and did Suffer, we just sort of, there wasn't anybody really left. The Adolescents had sort of splintered into 1,000 bands, and TSOL was a different TSOL. And I think Mike Ness may have been in jail. But yeah, there just wasn't a scene to come back to with that kind of support. We tried to help each other out as we were moving along, but it wasn't the same.
What was Mike like as a young man? He fascinates me as a figure. He's like the Johnny Cash of punk rock, isn't he?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he's more that now than he was then.
Right.
But I think that's something that he found his way. It was funny. The whole Social D crew was, they were very fucking cool. You know, they were the guys.
Always had chicks around them and stuff like that.
Yeah. God, I swear to God, they all have these Volvos. I don't know if you've ever seen these things. Volvo makes this car that looks like a 1940s, like gangster car.
Yeah, I can imagine it. Yeah.
But they're little. They're not tiny, but they're like a smaller version of this, you know, full gangster car. And everybody, all of their friends, all the crew, they all drove around in these cars, and they all had slick hair, and they all rolled the pants, and they, you know, they all had cigarettes in their sleeves, and they were just these guys. Like, fuck, these guys are so cool. So they were their own sort of world, and Mike was just, I don't want to say he was the leader of that, but he was the singer of Social D, and it was just sort of, oh, it's Mike, and you know, he just has this sort of quiet way about him, and the way he talks is sort of a, for some reason he has a drawl.
Yeah.
You're like, all right, cool.
Yeah, they're interesting bands, all of them, yourselves included. Like, everybody was unique and different. Although you were part of a community and a scene, everybody had something unique to offer. And, you know, Circle Jerks, kind of, you were saying, just came a little bit before you, but your stories were very intertwined, it seemed like, in those early days, a lot of shows together. And, you know, on many ways, you couldn't have had two more different bands, kind of with the lyrical content and the approach. Like, one's this kind of very irreverent, party, destructive, chaotic group. Obviously, you guys are a bit more considered and thoughtful and political, but I gather you played like loads and loads of shows together coming up, right?
We did. But I mean, when you say loads and loads, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't hundreds, tens. So we played with them a lot, but it may have been more to do with just there were fewer bands.
Right. Yeah. That makes sense.
There just really weren't that many bands to choose from, and you know we learned sort of early on that one way to get shows was basically just to play for cheap, you know, and don't be saying like, well, we want $100. It's like, no, we'll play for beer. So you know,
just to make it happen. Yeah,
well, yeah, because then you get put on these bills, and you know, a lot of the promoters for some reason really believed in us. You know, they believed in us enough to call us when the Ramones came to town or you know, Discharge was playing at the Santa Monica Civic. So it's like, all right, we're getting these calls, so there's something there. It may have been more to do with, from my point of view, being where we are now. I would say the Circle Jerks probably had more to do with putting us on their shows than anything else. Because I know Keith liked us and Greg liked us and Lucky liked us. I don't think Roger knew we were even alive. but I think that, you know, there was part of this taking a band under your wing sort of concept with the Jerks, and that was always fun, and they were cool guys. We were always cool together.
Talk to me about Jack Grissom, Jay. I just find that man so fascinating. I got to see him play I think last summer, I want to say, in London, and he was just kind of like telling all these stories in between songs that you didn't quite know whether they were real or not. But I guess with someone like Jack, they must be. But he was talking about like dropping acid and stealing rich people's yachts and all these wild stories. And you're like, and he'd sort of finish everyone, and that's a true story kind of thing. What a character. Was he always like just far out there?
Yeah. With Jack, Jack's a little like Fletcher, where it's like whatever he's telling you, even though it's like mind bending, it's only part of the story. Where you're just like, oh, and then it got worse. You're like, oh. Yeah. There was a point where I guess TSOL as a band was having some problems internally, and Mike had quit. Mike Loach quit, and Jack called me and said, "Hey, man, do you want to step in?" And I said, "Sure, I'll fill in." And I went down to live with Jack.
Can't imagine, man.
No, you can't. All of those things that happened, and it was just sort of it was an eye opening experience of like, wow, this is what it's like to just live full on 24/7 hours, just like you're just always on. It's taxing. It's very tiring.
Were you still the party guy when you were living with him? Was that in that time period?
Yeah. Oh, totally.
So yeah, totally. You were running wild together.
Yep. Yeah. That was great and not great at the exact same time.
I think with everybody who decides at a certain point, like, this isn't healthy, for you, was it evident looking back that it was always that way, or did things take a change at a certain point? Like, was it healthy to a point and then things got out of control, or do you think looking back it was always like that propensity was always there to push it to the limit?
Yeah, no, if I look back to the first time I ever even had a drink, I drank way too much gin, and you know, it's like everything that I'd ever done from that point on was too much of whatever it was. You know, here, eat these mushrooms, not the whole bag. Here, take this LSD, not that whole tab. That was me. I didn't seem to have an off switch. And that's me looking back to when I was 14 years old. Yeah. You know, this life obviously allows you to sort of juggle that if you can, and get away with it a lot more than you would at a 9-to-5 where your boss would be like, "You can't show up hungover like this." I mean, I can show up on stage hungover as long as I can get close to the right note. It's like, all right, Jesus Christ, he's hungover, but whatever. It's not until it just, you know, you're one of the things that is said at some of the meetings is you admit that you're powerless over alcohol, which is like, yeah, I'm pretty much, if I open a bottle, I have to finish all of the alcohol in the world. But the second part of that is, and that your life has become unmanageable. And that's the part where it's like everything in my life is just garbage because I'm just drinking my responsibilities away. I'm not paying attention to anything. And this isn't really how I want to live my life.
Well, I guess, was it 1990 when you originally called time?
Yeah.
Were you at that point in like a good place mentally in your life? Were you happy?
I was fairly newly married. The band was doing great, and we're going on international tours. I'm working at Epitaph. Like, you know, everything is sort of okay. I had no reason to be unhappy, and in all honesty, I wasn't unhappy. I wasn't one of those people that was drinking to assuage my fears or angers. I just seemed to have this problem with drinking. I would start drinking and I couldn't stop. You know, maybe early on when I was younger, that drinking sort of was the social lubricant that helped me talk to girls at parties, but I was well beyond that. Now I just had a problem with drinking. And you know, looking back at that and doing the work that I've done now, it's like we talk about drugs and all these things that these crazy, shitty things that you do. It's like, but I would have never done any of that if I wasn't drunk. You know, someone coming up and saying, "Here's these keys to this car, steal that car and drive it down there." So if I was sober, I'd go, "I'm never going to do that."
Yeah.
You know, but you
Jack might do that with a super sober head.
Well, yeah, you know, you're right. He would. And that's, that's kind of that thing where it's like you kind of have to admire that, like, wow, you just do this Stone Cold stuff.
But most quote-unquote normal people, you're right, they'd have their thinking head on and they'd go, no, that's a stupid idea.
That's a bad idea. I'm going to end up in prison or you know, whatever. But all of my trouble sort of came from my inability to not drink. And so that was why I said, I've got to make a change, and I can't seem to do it by myself.
Isn't it funny, looking back at the Bad Religion album releases, there's a funny part in the book where you say the one record that I wasn't there for was when they got the keyboards out and went all progressive. So, you know, even though I'm not necessarily in that main songwriting duo, I need to be around at all times just to make sure that doesn't happen again. When you left the band, what were you up to at that point in time before Suffer, before you came back for Suffer? Were you just kind of working a normal job? Were you still playing music? What was going on?
I had when I walked out of the studio when we were recording that record, I got through one song and said, I'm not doing this, and I walked out, and that was I was in TSOL, so I was in two bands. I was also in a band called Wasted Youth, but Wasted Youth wasn't really doing very much because Danny had left and Al Stieritz had left, and so we were trying to make this band happen. But I was in other bands, so I didn't really mind leaving Bad Religion because I was in these two other bands. But then Wasted Youth went to their third singer, and I was like, I don't want to do this anymore, so I left that band, and now I'm solely in the Jack Grisham TSOL, now Cathedral of Tears, because now he's out. I'm living with him. We're starting this other band. And it was, living there was a little too much for me, so I came back to live with my mom, and they just got another bass player and went and started playing shows without me, and I went, I guess I'm out. And that was a moment, probably 84, 85, where I just sold all my gear. I said, I don't want to play music anymore because it's just disappointing. So I sold everything I had, and I went to, I met a girl that Greg had actually been dating years before, and ran into her, and we started dating, and her dad had a machine shop where he just made, you know, screws for NASA and parts for hand grenades or whatever. And I went to work in a machine shop. And so I made little precision parts for 9 hours a day. But I don't know if I was happy, but I just kind of figured that was what was going to be my life.
Yeah.
And then and then after a couple of years of that, Greg Hetson called me because Flea was playing bass in the Circle Jerks and had left because obviously the Chili Peppers were now the biggest band in the world. And Greg called me and asked me if I wanted to play. And I said, I don't have any gear, but I think I do want to play. And so that's how I got back into music, was going back and actually playing with the Circle Jerks just for one show, but, you know, doing rehearsals and going out and buying whatever crappy gear I could get and just getting back into it. That just, you know, then after I did that, then Greg Raffin called me and said, hey, you know, you want to get back into Bad Religion? And that was 86-ish. And I said, yeah, I really enjoyed my time with the Circle Jerks. I think, you know, I missed playing. I missed being in a band. And that was 36 years ago. So
things worked out all right. It's interesting,
yeah,
isn't it? I think certain people can... I heard you on another podcast actually saying that your son, who used to play with Dave, had done it for a while and was like, yeah, that was, you know, a fun experience, but that's not for me. I'm going to go and just work and stay at home and not be the on the road tour guy. And I think with some people, you're not complete unless you're doing it, right? And that's not necessarily just touring and being on the road, but I mean being in a band and being a part of that world. I think for some people it's like, if you're not doing that, you're not quite whole, because that's what you're destined to do. I believe in that anyway.
I think so. My wife is a painter, and you know, she wakes up in the morning 4:35 in the morning and just heads off to the studio before any of us are in the house or awake, and she's in the studio painting every day. And you know, she doesn't have to, nobody's paying her to be there. She's just painting and working on stuff, and it's that's her passion. She's just driven by this and has been since I met her.
I love the painting that she did for the Cokie the Clown record. I thought it was so good.
It was really good. It was actually really terrifying. I'm like, wow, that's really good. That's actually sad.
It is, isn't it? It's heartbreaking.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking. She did a great job with that. But you know, I think a lot of people play music, but when you get addicted to that whole thing, that's hard to break out of. And like you said, you know, some people are just destined to do this. It's like, I told Miles, he was playing bass with Dave, and I said, you're technically a better bass player than I will ever be.
Already. I love it.
And, you know, he's just a massive metal guitar player. He's a phenomenal guitar player. It was funny. He said, he's playing guitar, doing all these leads, and he goes, I just want to get better. And so I called Dave Massey and I said, hey, can you give Miles some lessons about like full metal stuff? And so it was like a couple of years with Dave Massey, and Miles was just a monster. But now he's playing bass with Dave Hawes. But I told him, I said, look, you're better than I'll ever be, but I can walk out in front of 100,000 people and not freak out and not forget notes because I'm comfortable doing that.
Yeah.
So there's different levels of what you're proficient at. It's like you can be really good technically, but you can't do it in front of other people. And I can go out in front of other people and jump around and smile and throw up and burp and not forget notes and be like, this is great. I'm having so much fun.
Originally, when you stopped drinking and doing everything else, were shows strange to perform sober? Had you been used to doing those under the influence of one thing or another? And was it difficult finding your feet doing it, you know, with a clear head, or was it quite exciting and exhilarating, or a little bit of both?
It was exciting, exhilarating, and I was like, oh my God, look at all this that I've been missing.
Yeah.
It was pleasantly cathartic. I mean, it was, I could hear pin drop in the audience when Greg was talking, and I could hear people talking at the bar. And I could just stand there and go like, oh, I know exactly what note I'm going to play next. And I'm looking over at Brian going like, wow, you're a phenomenal guitar player. Just all of this stuff is just like, oh, I forgot all this stuff. This is great. And the Brian part was the second sobriety. The first part was just more Brett, so.
Well, when Brian joined the band, I love the book so much. I'll mention the book in the intro, don't worry, but I obviously haven't like directly referenced it yet, but I read it and I loved it. And I kind of enjoyed, I spoke to Brian about a week ago, he was on the show, and it seems like for a while there, you guys were, you know, you were running partners and you were the two that would get up to mischief with each other before you both then got sober. Can you look back on that stuff and you know, kind of cherish some of it before it got out of control? Do you have happy memories of misspent times boozing and partying with Brian on the road?
Oh, totally. I don't look back on anything that I did with regret and go like, oh, I wish I hadn't done that. I'm like, that's what we did. That was part of who we were, and it got us where we are, and I don't regret any of it. You know, the one thing I regret was what happened in South America when I drank too much with Fletcher. That's the one drinking thing that I regret, because that actually affected the show. And I don't think that anything that I'd ever done before or after that affected the show the way that did. That was really just, I can't play a note. I shouldn't be out here right now. This is, but I don't remember any of it. This is just what I've been told. So, that's, you know, okay. So of 40 years, that's my one and only regret.
That's pretty good going, isn't it? And thankfully the days before smartphones as well. So hopefully there's no footage of it on YouTube, right?
I keep waiting for it to show up, but I haven't seen anything yet.
You got away with it then. I love it. Have you got any good Warped Tour stories, Jay, from the party years?
All of them. I mean, yeah.
Are there any that got left out of the book?
All of them. We didn't talk about, like, we just didn't talk about a lot of the stuff that happened on the Warped Tour, because it was, the Warped Tour was, you
it's
know.
It's its own beast, right?
it was. And during the day, you know, everybody's there and you're playing your show and you're doing whatever. Not much, you know, during the day there was a little bit of buffoonery, but usually not much. But it was when everybody left and it was dark outside that just, you know, everybody just lost their minds because we were just, you're in the middle of a field at summer camp and you got nothing better to do than take drugs and float down a river on a raft. It's like, okay, cool. So, the most of it was just sort of pleasant, drunken barbecuing, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, summer camp on the road.
Yeah, there were some instances where, you know, things got a little crazy. Some fires maybe got out of control, and we probably put some stuff in some waterways that we shouldn't have. But it happens, you know. You just move on and go to the next town.
I guess it was just that perfect storm, wasn't it, of, you know, like skateboarding and alternative music just rose to the forefront of the mainstream, didn't they, and kind of took over for a minute there.
We got on a 98, and that was sort of that was right in the beginning of that door opening for, you know, the X Games and Tony Hawk Pro Skater, and everything's just sort of blowing up in terms of this Southern California lifestyle that you're presenting to the world.
Yeah.
And so there was good, you know, 4 or 5 years there where it was, for lack of a better word, I would say that it was dangerous. And eventually that danger started taking its toll on Kevin Lyman and his insurance policies, because the first thing to go was the motocross guys, which was my favorite part. Was like, these guys were my buddies, and you know, watching these guys made us look like idiots. Then the big skateboard pipe goes out, and you know, all these things start leaving, because it's just, you can't manage that. So I always look back and say those unmanageable years, you know, 97, 98, maybe 2002, were like that was the time where the Warped Tour was at its most dangerous. And then it just gets a little, I don't want to say corporate, but it just gets a little safe and sane.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I guess everything has its run as well, doesn't it? Like all good things, eventually, particularly when they're successful and popular, they can never quite retain that, I don't know, naivety almost and purity that they have to start out.
Yeah, that's the hard part to, in any art, you know, the hard part to keep hold of is that naivete, because that's what got you here, not knowing any better. I didn't know the rules. Therefore, I broke them and made my own rules that everybody liked. And you try to not ever forget that. You try to always remember, like, breaking the rules is what got you here.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
What's really interesting about the story of your band is it's so linked to just the story of punk as a whole in the US. Obviously, Suffer's this kind of seminal record that gets talked about all the time is really influencing so many of the bands that followed. And then you had that explosion that Epitaph was really, you know, at the center of, which obviously is intrinsically linked to the story of Bad Religion as well. Then the Warped Tour. There's like all these phases where punk kind of becomes like this dominant thing that takes over the world for a brief time. And Bad Religion are kind of like right there throughout all of it. And it's amazing when so many bands that you came up with, you know, mainly just did sort of one record that stood out and inspired people, and then either bands break up or they do one more and then they break up. But you guys were there at the start, and I mean, you're still there now, 40 years in. It's wild. What do you think the secret to the longevity of this band has been, if you could even answer that?
The lesson from Into the Unknown is probably one of the biggest parts of us being able to say that, look, we did all that. We broke up. We made our mistakes. We had our ego balloon popped. And that always helped us to put ourselves in check. And as we were growing, and as everything around was growing, we were able to kind of step back and say, look, this is all fun and this is all great, but it's not the end all be all. It doesn't make our lives important. This is something that we do together, but individually we all have things that are important in our lives. And we just sort of remembered that why we wanted to do this wasn't as important as us breaking up or fighting about things. And if we did fight about things, we had learned how to resolve those fights, you know, and get through it without thinking like, you know, we have to break up because of irreconcilable differences. We don't have that. We don't have, you know, he's a dick. It's like, well, yeah, he's a dick. But you know what? If you quit the band and go work in an office, the guy at the desk next to you is a dick too. So
what a great way of looking at it. Yeah.
These are just things, and it's just not that important. It's not important to have your way or the highway. So we've all sort of just gotten there over years of making mistakes. So now we're, you know, here we are with, you know, Brett has quit twice, I've quit once. We've all had big blow-ups, we've all had big fights, but now we just, you know, we still have fights, but they don't linger. We just don't have that, and this is, it's not like, well, now you're older and you know better. No, this has been really since we set out and did Suffer. You know, when we made Suffer, no one gave a shit about Bad Religion, and I mean that. We were like, nobody cared about what we were doing. We were in the studio, nobody cared. We made a record. We didn't even know who was going to buy it. We liked it. We said, this is a good record. We like this, but we didn't, you know, had no idea what it was going to mean. And then as it started getting traction and picking stuff up, it's like, oh, people really like this. Well, we better do another record. So we made No Control. Oh, they like that. We better do another record. So we got into this pattern of wanting to do things. And if there was ever a time where we or any individual sort of got like, I'm important, the rest of us would just go, yeah, no, we did that once before. We made that mistake. We're not. We don't do that. We do what we like. And there aren't really... You know, the sign at the door says, leave your ego outside.
Yeah, that's an important lesson, isn't it? Which so many bands, as soon as a whiff of success comes around, they throw that out the window, don't they? Because it's like, oh, now we're going to be huge. Now I'm going to just, you know, put all of the kind of greater good aside for personal gain. And greed ruins so many people, as does ego, doesn't it, in this game?
I think so. I think there comes a point where, you know, people will say, you're really popular. And one member will stand up and say, and it's all because of me.
Yeah.
And that's a really hard thing to deal with, especially when you're emotionally immature. And if you're in a band, I got to tell you, man, you're living a Peter Pan lifestyle. This isn't the most mature lifestyle to lead. So it's a struggle to deal with those emotions. And I think when you collectively have this idea that we jokingly put ourselves in our place, that sort of helps everything. You don't take everything personally. You realize like, look, this, we're just in it for the better good. And we do this because we like it. And over the years it's become how we make our living. And it's like, okay, this is all fine. So why disrupt this with ego?
Go on, Jay. Sorry.
No, go ahead. No, you go ahead.
I was going to say, was there anything that you talked about in the book that came up in the book that helped resolve certain issues that were perhaps kind of not quite fully resolved? Like, was there anything that came up where you thought, oh, it'd be good to just air this and finally talk about this openly? And was there any moments like that where the process of creating this book brought about real closure for yourself or for...
No. You know, honestly, I think that as the book was sort of unfolding and becoming the book that it is, you know, we're never that far apart from each other, especially, you know, this year doesn't count, but as the book was being written, Jim was out on the bus with us. And so, you know, you see that you spend, you know, 26 hours a day with each other. You're just constantly with each other. And so if you're talking to Jim about something that Brian has never heard before, he's just right there saying, like, I didn't know that happened. And so now you're having that conversation. You know, there wasn't really many eye-opening things in the book. I think one of the things that even as a band, when we started talking about the book, we just kind of sat and said, we as a band sat and said, like, look, let's just not talk shit about each other or people that were in the band and aren't anymore. Let's not be that band that just, like, you know, writes a dirty book. What's the point of that?
Yeah.
We can save that book for when it's over.
and nothing but the truth. So help us God.
Yeah. It wasn't like there was like, oh man, I can't wait to tell this story. There just isn't with us. You know, we're a band that essentially loves science. And so a lot of stuff that we do is just really well thought out. It's like, well, this is the process that we have to go through. You know, we sort of don't have a lot of emotions attached anymore. I think when we were younger, there were, because you're a kid. But now it's sort of like, this is the process of us being allowed to say the things that we feel. And we each respect that process. And I think that was a big thing. It's not in the book, but that's something that, like, it's a band philosophy that we respect the process of the band. It's a machine. You respect the machine. And if you disrespect the machine, it will set you down.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you're kind of directing the ship with logic and reason as the guiding lights, then you realize that sometimes it's, you know, it's about the bigger picture, isn't it? And the greater good. And that's above individual interests or hangups.
Yeah, I think you can let your emotions get the better of you, especially in you know, this, people don't, you know, you always hear artists talk about, you know, it's stressful. And I don't want to be one of those guys, but it is stressful to walk out on stage and entertain. And it's like, oh, I'll get another job. It's like, that's not what I'm saying. I'm not complaining about it. I'm just saying it's this. I try to tell people, they say, what's it like to walk out on stage? And I go, well,
it's high pressure, right? There's pressure there.
It is. It's not, you know, it's high pressure, but what it feels like is like you're in this slow motion train wreck for 2 hours and you're just in it. You're just sitting in this chair in this train wreck that just keeps happening for 2 hours. Like, well, here I go. I'm in this wreck. And not to mean that it's bad, but that's sort of the adrenaline, the emotion that you're feeling is like just, you don't want it to end, but you just kind of can't see what's coming next and you never know. And there's, that takes a toll on everybody. So, you know, giving people that leeway of knowing that after 9 or 10 shows in a row, somebody may snap because it's hard to deal with that. You kind of go, hey, I totally understand. You don't fight back and go like, well, you're just a dick, because you just understand that, like, I get it. It's stressful because we're all in this together. It's this stressful joyride. And I think that's sort of what helps us. And it certainly helps us understand other musicians as well, because I get it. It's tough. It's hard on everybody.
When you go and you play with the Gimmies, obviously it's an entirely different experience. put me in the kind of the psychological picture of what it's like going from Bad Religion to then going out and I guess what feels like just having unadulterated fun with that band, who are such a hilarious, entertaining group. Is it just a nice change of pace for you as a musician and as a person to just break things up in that way and go out with them and mix it up?
Yeah. That's sort of the, you know, like one of the philosophies of bass guitar is learn everything and then throw it all away. And that's whatever. I've never known what the hell that meant until I got in the Gimmies. And that's like, so learn everything, take everything that I know and play it all at the same time. and there just aren't rules. There's just this desire to be as entertaining as humanly possible. And the amount of fun that it, like, because in Bad Religion, if you kind of just really blow it on stage, you're raising your hand and you're feeling pretty bad about like, oh God, I fucked that song up so bad. But with the Gimmies, you're like, I wonder how much more I can fuck this up. You kind of want to, you're like, oh man, I'm making this terrible. This is great.
Do you rehearse together a lot before you go out on tour or not? Does everybody just kind of learn the songs on their own?
Yeah, you learn the songs on your own. And if you don't know the songs when you walk out on stage, you're punished. So that's every show is rehearsal for tomorrow night. Every single show is rehearsal for tomorrow night.
Tomorrow night we'll get it. Tomorrow night we'll get it.
Totally. Doesn't matter. You're playing the biggest stadium in the world and tomorrow night's show is more important. Tonight is just practice for tomorrow night.
What are your favorite songs to play with the Gimmies? Have you got any particular favorites?
I like them all, but there was a thing that we were doing where Spike was playing he was playing a Bowie song and he was singing it in German Heroes. He was doing Bowie Heroes, and me and Scott Shiflett were kind of backing him, and Scott was sort of playing this really haunting guitar. And I was trying to hold that one line down, and it's, there's not much to it, but for some reason, like being out with Spike when he's playing the ukulele and singing and we're just sort of backing him, that every night that would just make the hair on the back of my neck stand up. And I thought, this is so good. This is real. You know what I mean by that? This is why I do all music. This is why I play all music, is to be here right now, doing this right now, because this is everything that I ever thought when I was 13 watching Randy Rhoads at the Starwood. This is everything I ever thought it would be.
Yeah, he's a real artist, Spike is. He's got an amazing voice.
Yeah, he does. He does. And he's just there. He is just a genuine talent. It's a privilege to stand behind him and watch him at work and go like, this is great. Yeah, this is great.
Scott's amazing as well. Amazing, amazing bassist, amazing guitarist. He's just like a proper musical virtuoso, isn't he, that dude?
Yeah, he's the real deal. Scott Shiflett is the real deal. He's that guy. He's the one that we all wanted to be when we were kids. There are a lot of people who can mimic guys like Scott, but there are very few guys like Scott. Eddie Van Halen was one of them, where it's like, look, people can sound like Eddie, but that's only because Eddie already did it. You know, like there are very few people that are that innovative, where you're like, wow, I didn't think that was possible.
Yeah. RIP Edward.
Yeah.
That was a sad loss, wasn't it, yesterday? What was really beautiful and touching about that, though, was just, and I'm sure it's the same for you if you're on there, like my entire timeline on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, everything was just Eddie Van Halen tributes everywhere. It was lovely.
Yeah, across all musical genres. It came on my phone and I actually had to sit down. I was like, wow. And I sat down and I thought about it for a minute. Just took a couple of deep breaths, because it really, that when your life flashes before your eyes and it takes you back to 1977 with headphones on, listening to Van Halen 1 and thinking, I've never heard anything like this.
Yeah, man. Eruption, just changed the game, yeah, didn't it?
Totally. You know, that just his playing definitely changed all guitar tone from that moment forward and what was possible on guitar.
Jay, this has been a really good chat. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you very much for taking the time and hanging out.
Thanks, Matt.
And coming on the show. I'd love to finish the conversation just with a little bit of reflection on both Brett and Greg. Obviously, you've known the pair of them for forever. It's a very unique relationship, and they're both just, you know, I mean, Brett as a businessman and a record boss and Greg as a lyricist, the pair of them as songwriters together. As a friend and as a collaborator and as a bandmate, what do those two dudes represent to you as creative forces and as, you know, friends in your life and your band?
You know, I it's funny because I take the business part from Brett out of that picture because I worked with Brett at Epitaph for enough years to have watched his decision making and think he's two steps out of the box in the forward thinking that he had to get Epitaph where it was. It was mind boggling to be part of that and watch his business acumen grow and his processes in to get that label where it is. But as band members and partners, it's really, really simple. Brett, as a lyricist as well, Brett writes his own lyrics for his songs.
Yeah.
Brett is the romantic, the always searching romantic, looking for retribution and salvation. And Greg is the scientist who just says, I have a lot of questions about the way the modern world and the popular thinking is, and I'm demanding answers. Not from myself. We've never really had many answers in most of our songs, but looking for someone to come along with a better philosophy than what we're being presented now. So those two things, the romantic and the scientist, it's the tennis match of Bad Religion, and it's why it works as having those two as songwriters, because if it's all science, it's not any good. If it's all romantic, I'm not saying it's not any good, it's just not the same. And having these two bounce back and forth between, you know, the romantic side of songs like You or Infected, and, you know, having Modern Day Catastrophist or you know, any of those songs what Greg writes as the science side of it, which is, you know, I'm going to go on a tangent here. Having Greg write songs like The Island to me is like, I love that. It's like, dude, that's so good. Or Changing Tide, where you're like, that's just so, but that's also science. So I'm kind of going off on a tangent because I love these guys.
No, tangents are good, my friend. Tangents are good.
But yeah, it's having those two together is how this works. I always tell people that Brett and I dropped out of school. I dropped out in 10th grade and Brett dropped out in 12th grade. And Greg obviously went on to get his PhD from Cornell. But the three of us never stopped learning. And all of my education and most of what I know and who I am has come in these long van rides where we just talked about everything, quantum physics, religion, geology, music theory. We just talked and talked and talked and never stopped, you know, having this voracious appetite for learning. And that has translated into the band as well.
That's the like total definition of life for me, is when you get to engage and communicate on a personal level with the people that you share the experience and the journey with, you know, and you get to form opinions and get insights and really kind of just like hash out these big questions and topics. I love that shit.
It would be mind-boggling to sit in silence in a van or just, you know, not to, I don't want to bag on anybody, but I, you know, just talking about, you know, to see that chick, it's like, I don't know. We have to talk about gravity.
Well, here's something that I've noticed a lot more with today, which is really saddening and annoying, is, you know, I'll be on buses or in vans with bands kind of a younger generation, and they'll all just be on their phones, head down on their phone, not talking to each other at all. And you're there, like, yeah, trying to chat to people and get a conversation going, and everyone's like, I'd rather be on fucking Snapchat or something. It's so frustrating.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're the bands that last, though, right? The bands that can be out on the road and the conversation never runs dry.
I think, and it certainly leads to more material for writing albums. You know, all of these things that you just, you're constantly aware of how you feel as a person, and your friends around you are prodding you. Well, why do you feel that way? It's just opening up all these pages of you know, more questions beget more questions, and but at the same time, it's thrilling and exciting. You know, I've said this a few times, but when Brett said one of the most difficult challenges in his life is to put a lifetime of emotion into a 3-minute song.
Yeah.
And I looked at him and I said, yeah, that's really it in a nutshell. It's not about writing like, oh, you know, I had this dream. It's like, no, I'm gonna put it all in. I'm gonna squeeze it all into this one song. Yeah, that's it. That's really it.
Well, sorrow's like that, and you know, we're all missing live music, and I've been all right with it for the large part, just trying to like focus on each day, live in the now, be positive, be present. And when I was reading the book, it was the first time in a long time really that I really, really missed live shows, is, you know, just reading about the lyrical content of sorrow and just imagining being in a field listening to a crowd full of people singing the lyrics to that song or with each other. I was like, fuck, I'd love to be in a field watching Bad Religion right about now. I bet you can't wait to get back out there.
A lot of us have been talking about what we're doing to sort of replace that energy, and there's some pretty crazy shit going on.
Well, no idea is too insane, right? At this stage.
At this stage, no idea is insane. It's like, sure, do whatever you got.
What's going on with writing? In the book, it kind of hints that the Age of Unreason might be the last full stop musically.
Well, I mean, I'll tell you what, we thought, I think Brett and I felt that True North was the last record because we were happy with it. It was a good record. And we didn't really know if there was, you know, anything else to write about. And I know that sounds weird because there's always something to write about. But at that point, we've got 300 and something songs. It's like we've written about almost everything we can think of.
Yeah. And you've been doing it 40 years.
Yeah. And then, you know, we're out on the road. And I remember Greg saying, I'm writing more songs right now. And I was kind of like, I didn't want to say why. I was like, I'm writing more songs. I go, okay. I didn't really think much of it. And he said, I don't think Brett's into writing right now. And I talked to Brett. This was back in 2018, or maybe 2017. And Brett said, yeah, I don't really know if I feel like it. And then all of a sudden, he started writing. And once the two of them were going, it's back to that tennis match that I said before. And you know, it came pretty quick to come up with Age of Unreason. And none of us were.
It's an amazing album as well. It's really, really great.
Yeah. By the time it was like, okay, here's the songs that we've got, and we all looked at each other and said, yeah, we're good with this. This is great. Let's make this record. And we've got Jamie on drums and Mike playing guitar, and it's like, yeah, let's do this. So I can say that we would look at each other and go like, well, we don't need to make a record after this because this is another good record after True North. You know, to say that we wouldn't is silly because there's no point in saying that. We may write another record.
There just
aren't any answers. There is no, we don't have, our contract is with ourselves. So it's not like we have an obligation to make 3 more records. It's like nobody really, we do whatever we want. So maybe, I don't know. I mean, it's funny. We toured for half a year on Age of Unreason before we had to stop. So it feels unfulfilled, like we didn't finish the process of touring on this, but no, okay. We're not alone. Everybody else is in the same boat. I don't know. I don't, I don't think that anybody has talked about we're writing pandemic songs.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We Greg as the scientist has already written 3 or 4 of those. You can go find them anywhere.
Well, what's crazy to me is even, you know, your most popular song, 21st Century Digital Boy, that song is as relevant now. It's more relevant now than when you wrote it. Like, that's such a prophetic song that, you know, you kind of predicted the way society and the world was going even then. And now we're in that song, aren't we?
Kind of. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, I think one of the things that I know about Brett is he is a voracious science fiction writer, reader. He Kurt Vonnegut is his guy, and he's just very into that whole realm. And so writing that song fits in with his ability to be Orwellian and predict, like, here we are.
Yeah.
You know? And it turns out that Big Brother isn't watching us. We're watching Big Brother.
Yeah, sad, but true. The book's out. The book's fantastic. I absolutely loved it. And I think that, you know, the guy had a pretty overwhelming task of trying to condense 4 decades worth of stories and experiences and material into it. But he's done an amazing job. Are you all very happy with it in the band? And nice to get all of it finally out there and share it with the world.
Yeah. We set out with a goal to basically tell our story. And you're right. You know, 40 years of material, it's not possible to write that book. It would be 6,000 pages. So, you know, the stories that were told were the ones that Jim sort of just followed up on, thought, oh, that's an interesting story. And he called Pete Finestone and say, did this really happen? And, you know, that was sort of Jim's call on which stories to follow. And there are millions of other stories that each of us have that just didn't make it into the book because, you know, no one jarred your memory and said, do you remember this happening? Oh yeah. but I think that for all intents and purposes, it's the story of how this band started from just guys in the valley. And then there's, you know, the trials of trying to be a normal band, and you can't be a normal band. You have to be, you have to be your own band. And do the DIY ethic because that's all you've got to work with. And then how you deal with when it works. You know what I mean? There's that, you know, be careful what you dream of because it just might come true. It's like, okay, well, yeah, it's not the worst thing, but sometimes you just have to go through all the trials and tribulations of learning. So I think the book in when I read it, the 6 times. It just felt like that was it had a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it sort of wrapped it up. I was like, wow, I feel like I know this band even better than I did before, and I'm in it.
Yeah, what's really cool as well is it's the story of, as I said earlier, it's the story of punk from the kind of hardcore scene through to, you know, its infiltration of the mainstream and beyond. It's the story of all of that. It's also the story of the record business, and as you say, kind of working from within inside that system, but then outside as well, and blazing your own trail and doing it on your own. Like, it's just a very rich, three-dimensional story that's got, you know, a happy trajectory, which is the kind of ideal package, isn't it? Is you want to have the grit, but you also want to have a positive message and a happy ending as well. Obviously, the story's still being written, but it's left on a very nice note.
Yeah, I think that if there were one thing that maybe, you know, of all the things that we're trying to say in the book about ourselves and our feelings and our passions, maybe it's that if you're an artist, and it doesn't matter whether you're, you know, a painter or a sculptor or a writer or playing music, there are ways to do this yourself. And you know, that if we can do it, you can do it. That was really always the philosophy of Bad Religion and Epitaph. It's like, well, we just did this because we didn't really have a choice. We didn't wait for someone to tell us what to do. We just did it anyway.
And now's the perfect time to be taking that message into, you know, putting it into practice, isn't it? Because this is the most uncertain time in my lifetime. And I think everybody who worked in the creative fields, it's, you know, nothing but uncertain for all of us. So now is the time to really kind of grab that bull by the horns and create your own destiny, isn't it?
I think so. I think it's important to, you know, define your passion. And I think a lot of times people mistake passion with fame or a paycheck. You know, I can't tell you the number of people that have come up to me and said, like, oh, I used to play bass guitar in high school. And I said, what happened? Well, you know, I got married. I had kids. I went to school. I got a job. I had a job. Why did you stop playing? Well, you know, it wasn't successful. I go, but I play all day long. I would play forever if I wasn't in a band, because I just like playing music. I never don't have a guitar in my hand. So much like my wife who paints, you know, this wasn't a ticket out. Playing music wasn't like, this is how I'm going to get out of here. I never thought like that. We didn't think we were ever going to be anything, just four guys in a garage. And, you know, that's that part of like the passion to want to do this is what should be driving all creativity. And if you firmly believe that what you're doing is your value, then it doesn't matter whether people like it or not. No, I like it, and that's enough.
Amen to that. Jay Bentley, you're a good man.
Thank you. Thanks, man. Appreciate that.
I hope that we can meet up in the real world in the new year. And yeah, you had a big tour plan with Alkaline Trio. I hope that does manage to get replanned and re-announced and all of that. And,
well, everything that we're doing is just sort of pushing that tour down the road, because it's like, we all like it. We all like the concept of it. And I know that the only kind of hurdle in there is Blink wants to get out on the road as well. And we've all said, like, look, we're, you know, Blink can go out and Matt can do that work, and then we'll give him his month off, and then we'll make that tour happen. We might do another tour first, but all of us want that trio tour to happen.
Yeah, it's just going to be down to Skibbo. Just tell him he's got to double up. Efforts must be doubled.
Yeah, maybe it'll have to be a Blink, Bad Religion, Alkaline Trio tour.
There you go. Three birds, one stone. Done.
There you go.
Thanks a lot, Jay. I hope to, as I said, see you again. Well, see you properly and talk again soon. I'll let you know when this goes up. And yeah, congratulations on 40 amazing years. And here's to the future, my friend.
Thanks, Matt. I do appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Have a great day, Jay. And
yeah, you too.
Till next time, dude.
Okay, Matt.
Cheers, mate.
Cheers.
Father, can you hear me? How have I let you down? I curse the day that I was born, and all the sorrow in this world. Let me take you to the hurting ground.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.